This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
Hi, Joe. Dr. Joe Livingstone.
Hi, Dr. Charlotte Shane, doctor of being Charlotte. How are you?
PhD in podcasting. I'm so happy to be back. When Bookforum reached out to me about us reviving Reading Writers, our podcast of two previous seasons, in service of Bookforum, I thought nothing could be finer. It was honestly like a dream come true, except for the fact that we're not paid, but that's okay. It has been a passion project from the very start.
True that Bookforum is not paying us a check in the traditional sense. We are now being distributed on the nation's podcast feed, which ought to bring us to the ears of a number of new people whom we hope very much will navigate to patreon.com/readingwriters to give us your money. Thank you so much in advance.
I think the only thing we've really discussed is that if you give us $5,000, you can come on the show.
$5,000? You downgraded it. I thought it was $10,000. But I'm okay with $5,000.
$5,000 each to me, $5,000 to you.
Oh, perfect. Yes, you're right.
They will both gonna be here.
Yeah, they will be separate checks. But yeah, you're right. it's many people's dream to appear on this podcast, and we want to make it happen.
Literally. I'm so excited to hear about what you've been reading, and I'm really excited that we're doing this with Book Forum, not least because I feel like there's not that many places that both of us have written for extensively. I guess like the New Republic and probably New Yorker Online, but Book Forum, I think, is like it's a real home for us both.
You're right. So Book Forum is a special institution. I'm not just saying that because they're not paying us. I'm saying it because I believe it.
Like, we don't make a habit of doing things out of the kindness of our heart.
No. You know, just the other day, my husband Sam is away, and I said, I'm going to miss you while you're gone. And he said, you're not just saying that. And I'm like, you know me well enough by now. I never just say anything. Like, if I say it, it's because I mean it. So...
Okay, exactly. At the same time, our stony hearts are, I believe, a little melted by how sweet people have been. Like, people enjoy the podcast. We've not even been like shoving it on our friends or made anything with a deliberate appeal to anybody else. So thank you for listening. Honestly,
yes,
it's a nice thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you to the original listeners, because it was really sweet during our hiatus to hear from people who I often did not know reach out and say, like, will there be more episodes, or I love the podcast, or that was really sweet and wonderful and unexpected. And, you know, it's like when you're on the airline, welcome to all the new listeners. We're so glad you're with us. Thank you for giving us a chance, and welcome especially to the VIP long-time listeners. You're the most special of all.
Yeah, seriously. With that said, Charlotte, what have you been reading lately?
So I recently finished The Letters of Vincent Van Gogh, and I knew about him what I think probably everyone does. The cutting of the ear, the giving it to a prostitute, the general mental illness and lack of respect in his lifetime. But there was so much I didn't know, and I found his letters very, very moving. He's a great wordsmith and very quotable. And he genuinely loved prostitutes, like in a deep way, not in a bacchanalian like revelry way. He loved them in like
a Jesus way.
Yes, yes. Did you know he? Sorry, probably a lot of people knew this. I don't know it. He wanted to be a Methodist minister like his dad, and he was a lay preacher briefly, and he wanted to be a missionary, but he got essentially like turned down from missionary work.
I may have known that once because there's quite a good In Our Time episode on Vincent van Gogh, but this, I don't remember that, no.
So he loved the Bible. I mean, all his life he loved Jesus, even after he basically said organized religion sucks and the hierarchy of it, everyone is sort of fraudulent. But there's this one letter that arrived kind of early in the whole collection, and I was like, he's my guy. He's my guy. Because he is, he's talking about his love for those women who are so damned and condemned and despised by the clergymen from the lofty heights of their pulpits. I do not damn them. I do not condemn them. I do not despise them. And then he's talking about this experience he has with a prostitute. And he says, that woman was good to me, very good, very dear, very kind, in a way I shall not even tell my brother Theo, because I strongly suspect that my brother Theo has had a similar experience. And of course, he's writing to Theo. And then he says, I didn't spend a lot of money. And I guess she was sort of like, should we drink first? And he said to her, you and I don't have to make ourselves drunk to feel something for each other. You had best put what I can spare in your pocket. And I wish I could have spared more, for she was worth it. And he just talks about how great the conversations he has. I mean, he loved prostitutes. Like, he really appreciated the intimacy he had with them, because his life was not a life that had a lot of romantic love in it. And he really craved that a lot in companionship.
It's very sweet.
I know.
And Theo was really important in his life, right? Like, most of the letters are to him? Or no?
Yeah. Theo was his younger brother and supported him financially, I'd say, for the bulk of his life. I think his father supported him for a while. And I think it's safe to say from the letters that Theo was kind of the great love of his life, Vincent's life. And Theo died very shortly after Vincent died of his suicide attempt. Theo did not kill himself, but it was just like he was already sick. And then when Vincent died, he sort of went very quickly after, and they were both in their 30s.
So the,
it's really sad. He says something to the effect of, I'm a really passionate man, and you know that the passionate is, or it seems that the passionate's doing a lot of work to indicate his mental illness. And he's like, but what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to just like not try to live a life? Like, am I supposed to, he thinks he says something like, should I be afraid of myself?
Wow.
His episodes toward the end of his life sound pretty horrifying, where he would like drink paint and drink the turpentine, and that period where he was mostly living in asylums. And I didn't know that he'd wanted to do this artist cooperative, and he was really fixated on making it happen with Gauguin. And and they did live together for a while, but it was did not seem to serve either of them. But the one thing that stayed with me above all, he's writing to a fellow artist, and he says that he has this idea of the Starry Night in his head. And he talks about how maybe some painters are kind of destined to just have this idea of a painting in their head. And it is so perfect in their mind that they're never going to be able to get it out. And it reminded me a lot of Ben Lerner's The Hatred of Poetry, which we mentioned before, which is that as a writer, as an artist, I think it's a pretty common / universal challenge. The minute you start, you're like, I can't do it. I can't do my vision. It's beyond me. And I just found myself spending so much time thinking about how incredible it was that he did it. And I just feel like we came so close to a world without Starry Night, you know? Yeah. He lived for so little time, and he had so many challenges.
And his paintings are really fucking good. No, seriously, like when you see them in real life, they're so good. They're so... Have you ever seen Michelangelo's David?
No, I don't think I have.
I'm not talking about the aura, right? Like in the like Benjaminian sense, but about perfectness. There's something about like perfection in the flesh, in an artwork, which is, it does something to you. And I think that Van Gogh has a similar thing.
He's so popular and famous now that there's almost a corniness, I think,
100%.
To being interested in him. But what you're talking about, like, the first time I saw Notre Dame, I was just absolutely rocked. Like,
it's the same as Michelangelo's David because it's so big and so perfect.
Just blown away. Like, people did this. This exists in the world that I live in.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect that. I wasn't like, we've got to see Notre Dame, my most favorite building.
Right.
I was just in Paris.
Yeah.
I don't sit around thinking about how Starry Night's so significant to me personally. You know, it's reading him. It's like thinking like, right, that was in someone's mind. That didn't have to come out into the world. But he did it. Like, real against all odds, against his
really
poverty, his mental illness, his isolation. He did it. So yeah, I recommend the letters highly.
That's beautiful.
Well, what about you?
That's a beautiful endorsement. Well, that makes me want to recommend also letters. Okay, so this summer, excuse me. This summer I was reading around this book draft that I've been working on. A lot of the concerns of the book are about the unsayable and how people treat and approach the unsayable, and that there is a sort of theological tradition behind it. And so I was looking at books that are I was kind of rereading some books that originally inspired me into writing the books, and some stuff that was recommended years ago by my friend Emma Janaski. When I was first telling her about it, she was like, oh, you should read Jeff Dyer's Out of Sheer Rage, which I remember reading at the time and was like, oh, this is good. And then I immediately hated Jeff Dyer, and then I remember being rude to him at a literary event for a thing he did with Ben Lerner at McNally Jackson. And now I'm returning to it, and I'm maybe like older and like non-defensive enough to not be so provoked by the character that he's using as his narrator, and instead being quite inspired by it. And that is a book about D.H. Lawrence and his sort of attempts to chase him around and visit the places where he lived, and then feeling things and not feeling things, and sort of like how research works. And his ultimate thesis is that D.H. Lawrence's best writing is his most like sprezzatura. It's stuff that was not like never nailed down into form for publication. And I actually kind of see what he's saying about the poetry, but it essentially serves as a long recommendation and explanation of why D.H. Lawrence's letters are so much better than everything else he ever wrote, which I'm not sure, because like, I absolutely love D.H. Lawrence. I'm just like that kind of, oh, you know, I'm that kind of like Smith's fan, I guess. Like, I just love him. And also, you know, a thin man, much afflicted by his illnesses throughout his life, and, you know, with a sort of death from tuberculosis ahead of him, and has maybe something of the Vincent about him. But there are a few different editions of his letters, and they are, as Jeff Dyer says, like extraordinary. And the images that rush into his mind when he's saying something quickly are his strength. There's one I just saved, which is really early in this edition. It's just the one edited by Aldous Huxley. It's written to William Heinemann and dated 1909. To H.C., I admit your accusation of impressionism and dogmatism. Suddenly, in a world full of tones and tints and shadows, I see a colour and it vibrates on my retina. I dip a brush in it and say, see, that's the colour. So it is, so it isn't. That's it. He didn't even sign it. What a letter. There's something that Jeff Dyer really gets at about like the pacing of Lawrence's writing, and I quite like his torturous, long-considered stuff, but he absolutely hits on something beautiful about his most casual writing and his deep relationships with other people. And I unreservedly recommend them. They will tickle you.
Are his letters copious?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He wrote a lot of letters. And he's very warm with his friends, which I don't know why I didn't expect that. I mean, I knew he was a very emotional man, but he's very, I don't know, he's always writing, you know, my dear, how are you? This one where she's writing to his friend Edward, I saw Elle yesterday, and she was rather than something that can't be read. She had decided beforehand she had made herself too cheap to me, therefore she thought she would become all at once expensive and desirable. Consequently, she offended me at every verse, and, thank God, if she had been wistful, tender, and passionate, I should have been a goner. I took her to the castle, where was an exhibition from the art school. Wonderfully good stuff. She stared at the naked men till I had to go into another room. She gave me a disquisition on texture in modelling. Why clay lives or does not live. Sarked me for saying a certain old fellow I met was a bore. Could not remember, oh no, had not the ghost of a notion when we last visited the castle together, though she knew perfectly, thought me a fool for saying the shadow of the town, seen faintly coloured through a fog, was startling, and so on. I just... They're perfect.
Yeah. Though that should maybe be my next read, if I just continue down the path of letters.
Well, I'm going to read Vincent's.
Okay, good.
We'll regroup.
Today we are joined by Ruman Alam, the author of four novels, including most recently Entitlement. And a very generous gentleman who's been very supportive and kind to me since we did an event at Word's New Jersey location.
That's right.
Like a decade ago.
This is one of the most fun things about this business is that you end up crossing paths with other people who do the same weird thing that you do. And you retreat for 3-4 years, write a book, host a podcast, make a movie, do whatever weird thing you're doing, but you kind of are bonded by going to Hoboken or Jersey City or wherever that shop is and doing an event on a Sunday afternoon. I feel like I've met a lot of writers in this particular way, and I love those relationships, especially because this work is so solitary. It reminds you that you do have colleagues out there, so it's like so nice that I have a colleague relationship with both of you, because Joe and mm-hmm. I also work together, so it's so like it's nice to occasionally be reminded on days that I spend the whole day here in this office by myself that actually I do know real people out in the real world.
Yeah,
that's beautiful.
Also, the thing I remember about that panel that you said that I thought was like so incredible is you said that you give every book on Goodreads 5 stars to like offset the stupid ratings. Indeed. It was so sweet.
I do indeed. That is still my practice. You know, congratulations to anyone who ever wrote a book. Like, it is hard. And I generally think, like, I love sharing my opinions about the books that I've read with people I know and trust. But I generally think my sort of responsibility in like the book ecosystem is just to be like, this book is good, read it.
That is so funny. You're literally a book critic.
Yeah, well, when I'm engaged in that in print, yes, that's a different kind of responsibility too. But even then, I don't think it's not really the job of the critic to say like, I liked this or I didn't like it. It's to make a larger argument about like what the book is doing and, you know, mm-hmm. its success or failure in terms of what it's trying to do. When you're on a place like Goodreads or Letterboxd, I do the same thing on Letterboxd. It's just like, great, these people made a movie. You should watch it. Maybe you'll hate it, but 5 stars, you know?
I just think it's so interesting that maybe as somebody, because you've published multiple amazing books, you feel a kind of loyalty to that side of the equation, where I feel none whatsoever. As a critic who's never published a book, but like will publish a book at some point, hopefully.
I mean, Goodreads is so stupid. So like, Does it do anything? No. Does me affecting someone's like GPA on Goodreads have any, you know, like who cares, you know? And sort of that, and I think that cuts both ways. Like, does it really matter to the ghost of Saul Bellow when I go on Goodreads and say like, wow, Augie March is a masterpiece, 5 stars.
He might.
Actually, that's a fair point. His ghost is probably as much of an egotist as he was.
But speaking of stupid things, we have been promised you're here to talk about something extraordinarily stupid, which is just the best news I've ever heard. I can't wait to find out more.
I mean, I think of both of you as such intellectuals. Like, I really do. Like, you asked me very kindly to do this show with you, and I was like, fuck, I'm going to have to read, like, The Confessions of St. Augustine or some shit to, like, impress these fools. And then I think you were both like, no, we can talk about any book. And at the moment that this invitation was extended, I was reading a book. I was actually listening to the audiobook that was so total an experience for me that I was like, well, I have to talk to someone about this. So Joe and Charlotte, like, lucky them, this is going to be what we talk about. And the book we are going to talk about is The Vanity Fair Diaries by Tina Brown.
Oh, juicy. Juicy.
Have you read this book? You're familiar with this book?
I've dipped into it over the years for information loads of times. There's just a lot of stuff that's in that book that's like a great fact check for things that people are lying about.
Yeah.
I've really, really enjoyed it whenever I have because I think that her reputation as an editor and as a writer is like really in its rehabilitation era. I think people are like, fuck, she was incredible and we took her and all of her kind for granted.
That was really the takeaway for me, is that we took that kind for granted. And I'm not sure whether that figure, the cultural figure of the prominent editor, the editor who's kind of a name brand, doesn't really exist any longer. So I'm not even really sure why I picked up this book. I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I have 2 kids, I have 2 teenagers, and they are not always, they're teenage boys, like they're not always like the most stimulating company, and sometimes I have to be in their company because I'm a father, and so I'll have to like cook dinner or fold the laundry or, you know, just be hanging out while they're doing their homework or ignoring me or whatever. And so I kind of ignore them and I put in my AirPods and I listen to audiobooks. I've listened to a ton of books the last couple of years in this fashion. I listen to all of My Struggle. I listened to the whole fucking thing. I listened to the complete Palliser novels and the complete Barchester novels by Anthony Trollope. I'm probably the only person maybe alive who has listened to Barchester Towers at the gym. but I love it. I love this mode of reading. And for whatever reason, Tina Brown was on my mind. Condé Nast was on my mind. There was a book that came out last year, I think, or earlier this year, rather, I think it's called Empire of the Elite. It was kind of a survey of the golden age of Condé Nast, Vanity Fair, and The New Yorker, the acquisition of The New Yorker, rather. So that media milieu was of interest to me. I think I'm older than you guys, so I worked at Condé Nast at the very start of my career. It was kind of running on fumes at that point. But I did brush up against that sort of residual glamour and that sense that like editorial budgets were, you know,
did
infinite.
Did you work at a magazine, at a title or at like Condé itself?
I did. No, I worked for a magazine called Lucky, which launched in 2000. Love.
Yeah, I remember
2000,
it.
I think.
I love that because, Kat Marnell the beauty editor there?
She was indeed. Kat was the beauty assistant. I'm trying to think if this is true. I don't know if any colleague I've ever had has ever made quite an impression on me the way Kat did. She is just such a figure. She is like a Keane painting come to life, right? And has like this huge personality. She's so much fun. And she's so like glamorous and crazy. And also just, I think, such a talented writer. And such an interesting thinker. So I knew Kat when we were both kids at Lucky Magazine.
Were you also then working with, I won't remember this woman's name, but I know Kat has written and talked a lot about her kind of mentor, Jean.
Yes,
someone?
Jean Godfrey June.
Yes,
Jean Godfrey June.
I have read her book, Free Gift with Purchase. Yeah.
Free Gift with Purchase.
And I adore that book, and I think it's out of print and has been even when I bought it and read it. But I feel like Kat's worship of her is totally warranted.
I don't disagree. I did work with her. I was the assistant to the editor-in-chief, so I had some kind of working relationship with everyone on staff in that capacity. Jean is a lovely person, first of all, but she is an incredible writer and a very exacting writer. And she cares deeply about the thing that she does, which is beauty, and she takes it very seriously. And that level of seriousness and that commitment to the way you write about something and the way you communicate about this thing that you know about and are passionate about was actually, I think, really instructive and is sort of testament to what I do think Condé Nast was adept at. And it's probably just down to money, right? The magazines were given enough money to hire people who actually knew how to do this thing well. And did it matter, or does it matter when you see those things done well versus when you see them done less well? And I think it actually does matter. And to be in this institution where there was a budget and a commensurate amount of care for every tiny thing, for the way a lipstick was photographed, for the way it was written about, was a good lesson. A kind of pointless lesson, because none of that really matters anymore, unfortunately. I had this feeling reading the Vanity Fair diaries, which are a series of diaries that Tina Brown kept from the time that she was first brought over to the States to consult on Vanity Fair, which was at the time being edited by an editor named Leo Lerman, through the time that Cy Newhouse and Alexander Lieberman, who was the company's editorial director, persuaded her to assume the editorship of the magazine, and sort of through her tenure there, right up to the moment where she's offered the editorship of The New Yorker. It is a sporadically kept diary, and it is a totally demented document that reflects a person, like a very high achieving, but also like kind of weird person who is like, I had a baby and he's the greatest thing in the world and I want to like lick his feet, right? Which is like so sweet. And then is like, I went to dinner with Henry Kissinger and Henry Kravis and we talked about George Plimpton and then Liza Minnelli came. And it's like, it's this ridiculous like name droppy artifact, which I think, Joe, to your point, it would be an excellent fact checking resource. If you ever needed to know whether Carolyn Rome had ever had lunch with Tina Brown, you could prove it, you know? But it is, in a way, kind of like Andy Warhol's diaries.
Oh, I've never read them.
Which are, oh God, if you ever, Andy Warhol's diaries are so mind-numbing and bizarre, much like Andy Warhol.
I have read them, you know, it's like, but I don't remember anything about them. But...
Well, because they're interminable and they're very shallow. It's just like,
they slide, I had slide lunch. Right off the brain.
It was $1.35. Jerry Hall was there. And beyond, you can kind of get off on the catalog of name dropping, but it's an extension of his other sort of performance, his other persona. Whereas this Tina Brown thing is like a deepening. It's like more human, but also more baffling. I don't know. It's so weird. It's such a weird, weird book. And nobody needs to read it. And yet I found it weirdly exhilarating to read it.
Is she from England, or was she just an editor at I know she edited Tatler way back.
She's from England. Which... She was very young when she was the editor of Tatler. She was kind of a star editor. And you have the sense that Condé Nast had their eye on her from an early moment when she had sort of turned the business of Tatler around. And she is also, and it's very, and she's very forthright about this. She's extremely canny. So she was the editor of Tatler when Diana married Prince Charles. And so Tina appeared on the Today Show with, I think it was Katie Couric, to discuss, so she was like on-air talent. She understood the media ecosystem that maybe she helped create, or that was inevitable in some ways, in which this one person was understood to be an arbiter of cultural taste. And the word that she uses, she sort of uses this word like the buzz or hot I used to work with an editor who worked with her when she was at Vanity Fair and then had gone to The New Yorker. And he would sort of mock her by talking about what's like hot. Is it hot? And it is funny. It is funny, certainly. But also, it's not, it's sort of, there's some legitimacy to that. Because I don't know, again, I'm 48 years old. But lately, I would say for the past year or so, I have found myself like at a loss for like cultural input.
Mm.
Like, what is the book I'm supposed to read? I don't fucking know. What is the restaurant? Like, what am I going to follow some 22-year-old girl on TikTok who's like, go to this restaurant in Chinatown? I don't fucking know how to get there. Like, that's not helpful to me.
Yeah.
In a way, I actually need an old woman like Tina Brown to be like, okay, here's where you're going to go. And all of those things that I was sort of, that was my young adulthood. In my young adulthood, those things existed. Like Barney's existed. Mm. And I could go to Barney's and sort of wish I was rich enough to buy something that wasn't like on sale on the co-op floor. And now I finally am old enough that Barney's doesn't exist anymore. And I will have to buy a sweater or something. And I'm like, I don't know where to buy a sweater. Like, I need someone to tell me some stuff, and there is no authority left in our culture.
Decentralization, and the devolution of, yeah, prescriptive editorial content. Yeah, I mean, and the thing is that the algorithm's just not as reliable because it's bribed. You know, like it's just not a real recommendation system.
There was plenty of payola and nonsense,
yeah, I guess so.
in the editorial, right, system I'm describing. Of course, like, they didn't really want me to wear Cole Haan shoes. Cole Haan shoes spent millions of dollars advertising in their magazine, so they would have to tell me to wear them, right? That's fine. Mm. I get it. You know, I've tried to train my algorithm. I sense that my algorithm might be close to Charlotte's, because when I look at Instagram, it's like, oh, do you want to see the Brown University crew team rowing shirtless?
I do.
And they'll show me like, oh, here are like 18 restaurants in the East Village where you can have a cinnamon roll. And I love a cinnamon roll, but like, I'm not going to go to 18 fucking restaurants in the East Village. Like, I do need like an old person, mm-hmm, to be like, oh, you want to go and sit down and have a French onion soup? This is where you should go.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. As seasons change and days grow darker sooner, it can be a tough time for many. That's why it's important to stay connected. It's time to reach out and check in with those you care about, and to remind ourselves that we're not alone. This November, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to check in on friends, reconnect with loved ones, and let them know that you're there. Just as it can take a little courage to send that message or grab coffee with someone you haven't seen in a while, reaching out for therapy can feel difficult too. But it's worth it, and it almost always leaves people wondering, why didn't I do this sooner? With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/thenation. That's betterhelp.com/thenation.
Yeah, and those places have to continue to exist as well, right? I was just had lunch with someone and I was saying, oh, all these vegan spots in New York closed, and they were places that had predated my living in New York. They weren't just like trendy pop-ups who were taking advantage of like plant-based, yep, trends. They were, in my mind, they were institutions. Like when I was first going to New York as a tourist, people would say, oh, you got to try Candle Cafe. And that they, it just feels like they've all been wiped out. And I guess that is the danger of being alive for a long time, is you see things change and then you're kind of like, what happened here?
You're like, I don't like this anymore.
Yeah, but yeah. No, but like the fact that Barney's is gone, that all of that is kind of wild. And even the functional elegance of the department store. You know, even when I was growing up in the middle of nowhere, it was like, yeah, you could go to Sears, go to JCPenney's, and you can get your school clothes and you can get your shoes and you can also like get whatever you need for the home.
I mean, this is like a whole other, we could have a whole other conversation about the death of the department store and retail more broadly. But like, again, I have kids. So like, you kids' feet grow like constantly, so you are constantly having to buy them new shoes, and we would drag them around looking for any place that would sell children's shoes, and you would go in and they'd be like, we don't have that size, you have to buy it online. And it's like, well, what is the point of having a store? Like, the purpose of the store is that you have the thing and then I give you money and I leave with the thing.
Yeah.
And the experience is so much richer than what exists now. And I can shop online if I know what I want, but if I don't know what I want, I can't just like go on the internet and be like, show me shorts. Like, that's not helpful to me somehow.
And there's nowhere to start from. That's the problem. I mean, because Google doesn't work anymore. Okay, I have actually, sorry, just to pivot on the same concept of centralization, right? Physical centralization and homogenization. What role do you think the fact that Tina Play really looks like Princess Diana played in her incorporation into American entertainment?
A huge part. A huge part. She is a lovely, like, telegenic woman
with the feathery hair,
beautiful 80s feathery hair. She describes a couple of times like her outfits of choice, and they're so good, they're so 80s. Like, I put on my Crisia dress and my little fur. It's like, yeah, I love all this shit. But a huge part, right? She did represent, I think, an American ideal of Englishness and a kind of her Europeanness validated her taste in a way that I'm not sure would be available, you know, to a lot of editors, right? Like, it's a reason that company would like isn't known for having turned out a lot of like Black editors, right? Like, they're known for enforcing a certain kind of ideal of like what taste looks like. And in fact, I was just recently joking because Vanity Fair has a new editor whose name I forget, but he looks like a drawing. Like, if the board, whatever board controls Condé Nast like sat down and like drew a picture of who the editor of Vanity Fair was going to be, like that's what they would come up with.
That's so funny.
He's like very square and like kind of handsome. He kind of looks like Pete Hegseth, actually. He's just kind of like
a young Grayson, vaguely telegenic.
Yeah, younger Graydon Carter, but like Graydon Carter is kind of a funny, like, idiosyncratic guy. Like, this guy is like very polished and like handsome. I don't know, he looks like a publicist or something, like, or like a society walker. Like, you would see him like escorting a doyen to lunch or something. And so, yeah, like, Tina certainly like fit a certain kind of mold. You know, and in Empire of the Elite, the journalist whose name I'm now blanking on does talk about whether or not Cy Newhouse, who was the billionaire owner of this family business, whether or not he may have been sort of a closeted gay guy, and that a figure like Tina Brown or Anna Wintour, who of course continues to serve at Condé Nast, would have appealed in some way to a kind of gay sensibility.
Well, they could definitely, the very spirit of discretion until such time as they're not. I mean,
yeah,
that's and quite like, an English
you know,
thing.
You know, and sort of like pretty and like tough and, you know, they're kind of like, Anna and Tina strike me as kind of having different public personas, but they're not wholly dissimilar from one another. They're just two women who seem like they're in control. And Anna's thing seems so impenetrable to me. And part of the charm of the Vanity Fair Diaries is that Tina is sort of frank with her reader. And you feel that you get a kind of controlled access. Like, and the diary is an interesting form. Generally, like, I keep a diary. I started keeping a diary after reading Helen Garner's diaries. It was a New Year's resolution. It's the only one I've ever stuck with.
Oh, good for you.
But there's so much deceit in the diary, right? Like, and it's a weird self-deceit, and it's a weird performance for like an audience that doesn't exist. So, like, why are you writing this down? Are you writing it down to document something for yourself? Are you writing it to document it for some future theoretical vindication at the hands of some larger audience? Like, it's really hard to answer. Helen Garner's diaries are very, like, you know, I fed the baby, Mm-hmm. I saw Sandy. She's a fucking cunt. I can't write a story for shit, and I hate myself. And it's like a very kind of honest thing. And Tina's diaries are much more like, I wore my crazy dress. The car came at 6. I had dinner with, you know, Ben Bradley.
Why is there something Churchillian about her and her diaries? Well, like, I'm writing for posterity from my role placed on the chair of greatness by God himself. Yep.
There is that. And, you know, I mean, well, Churchill won the Nobel Prize in Literature, I believe, right? Like,
I don't know. I think he did.
I don't know if Tina's going to really touch that as a diarist, but there is something that is really fun about this book. Like, it is so fun. And it is a really fun audiobook because she reads the audiobook.
Love.
So it is as though you're getting a series of increasingly demented voice notes, voice memos from someone you know who has like a high powered job. And they're telling you about it. And some of it is like, as all three of us have kind of worked in the contemporary media, you know, labyrinth, mm-hmm. like the depressing, the three of us understand the sort of reality of contemporary media.
Right.
And there is something that is kind of like heartbreaking, but also like, oh God, we just missed it. Like about the media ecosystem that she's describing.
So you're so right. And yet, you know, we also, for what it's, you know, for what our careers are worth. I mean, I say that we're all accomplished, but there are these sort of wisps or ghosts as almost like, you know, currents on the wind or something in the remnant of it. Like, sometimes I wonder if I could like press a button and quantify all of the positive discrimination I've received throughout my like adult life as a British person in America. And then it was all suddenly taken away, you know, in one moment, like where would I end up? Would it be just like, I don't know. Would I just suddenly be like spirited up to the top of a tree because I was a tree surgeon because I had to like quit so long ago, you know, or like on a tanker in like the Adriatic or something. It's horrifying to think you'd probably
make more money that way.
Oh God. So like there's definitely things like, you know, the prestige ghosts remain, and sometimes well, maybe not Charlotte, because Charlotte's so like, what's the
I
can't think of the word, but all right, I'll tell you what I think it is that I know that I have, and I can imagine maybe like a younger Ruman doing this, of like unconsciously writing towards or like trying to fill a like format that was engineered by reading magazines as a young person.
Yeah.
And so the magazininess, there are little phrases that, you know, I'm sure are from like reading music magazines obsessively as a teenager that like pop up every time I write about music sometimes. Like there's a formulaic. Okay, but as in, you know, like Homer was an oral formulaic poet, you know, like there are these little motifs in writing from magazine era, which I totally unconscious for me. And yet like something that you reach towards to know what to say. Many ghosts.
I think those conventions of the form persist. I don't know. I think there's like a, yeah, we've inherited the conventions, but I'm not sure we've inherited the editorial guidance.
Well, quite.
Or the money required to invest in actually making something good. And you can tell, I hope you've all had this experience, but that when you work with an editor who is good, who has like knows what they're doing and they are given the leeway in their place of work to actually spend the time on something. It's kind of like exhilarating. I just wrote like a very small piece for The New Yorker, and my editor like called me like 8 times and would like read it through to me on the phone. And I was like, God, I can't believe you're spending all this time on this stupid thing. But it was like, oh, you care so much about this and you're so smart. And I can see, I'm like watching you think out loud and you're articulating what your goal is for the piece. And for me as the author of the piece, like that's like a dream relationship. But most often, I think in my experience of publishing right now, it's like, okay, turn in the piece, like we'll spell check it. Like,
yeah. I was going to say about Charlotte, independent minded was what I was trying to think of. But then I just Googled like synonyms for independent minded.
Yeah, I did and Google there aren't synonym any, for something.
Except for the only one that's like a single word and not a phrase is maverick, which I love.
Oh,
you are kind of a maverick. Yeah.
It was like John McCain, right? Was that his thing? Yeah.
Sarah Palin. Yeah, Sarah Palin.
I am remembering.
You and Sarah Palin, so much in common.
Yeah. What's the time span of the diaries? It's about like 15 years or something?
I want to say it's like 85 or 84 to 90. Oh, God, the late 90s. She became the editor of The New Yorker in the late 90s.
And then you said it's like she's getting increasingly deranged. What type of progression do you think it's because, is she refining her style as a diarist with that eye toward a reader? Or do you think it's that something about her life is shifting, or kind of, I'm really curious about that development.
So I had a sense that there was, on some level, that she couldn't quite believe what was happening to her. That like, after a certain point, like, because the excesses of Condé Nast were quite excessive, that like, she went from being kind of charmed by it to then being like, well, this is actually fucking crazy. And one of the conditions of her continued employment at Condé Nast was that Cy Newhouse personally would pay for her elderly parents' healthcare. Extraordinary perk, not maybe as uncommon inside of that building as it might seem, because I think he also famously helped Andre Leontali buy a home for his grandmother at Anna Wintour's intercession. I know that, you know, I was privy to the mortgage arrangement between my boss and the Condé Nast company. It was a totally crazy agreement that was struck me even then when I was 22 as like quasi-legal because it happened inside of an email. It was like, here's how we're going to buy this house for you. So it was a company like that.
Wow.
And I think Tina recognized that. And she'll describe, like, she and her husband wanted to buy, they bought a house in Quag, and she's describing this sort of long process of trying to buy this house at the beach and sort of like their dreams for it. And it's the kind of conversations that like people have when they are our age. But I think she's aware that there's some absurdity to what she's able to accomplish by virtue of her job. And I think she then sort of enjoys documenting it, maybe just to, for herself. Like there is a sense, it's an unbelievably name-droppy book, but I get the sense that like she's kind of amused by it. Or that she's kind of like, I can't exactly believe this, like, but it's what's happening.
It
you know,
sounds,
she described, yeah. She's like watching 9/11 in Henry Kissinger's bedroom.
fucking hell.
You know?
There's a sense that, she's aware that she's at like Versailles or, you know, like the Russian court of the 1900s.
Yeah.
Which then I had that thought. And then I was thinking, okay, well, what's the literature of that? And then, I don't know, most of it's like historical kind of imagination, although there were those great like novels of the French 18th century, except that then I was thinking, well, all the Russian novels, they do sound really name droppy because people are constantly saying each other's full names and in different versions.
Yes.
So it kind of sounds like someone who's like clunkily being like, and then I was with you know, Alexandra,
well,
blah, 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 blah. Yeah,
I feel like the way you phrased it, Ron, was very charitable, because I'm like, yeah, you know, if I went to lunch with Joe, and I don't know, I'm trying to think of someone I'd be really impressed by, were there, you know, I have a journal that's really just, it's garbage. I'm not imagining that one day it'll be published or turn to anything, but I would be kind of like, I got to have lunch with so-and-so today. You know, it'd feel kind of like you should be recording that for your own posterity somehow, even if not for like some type of larger appreciation.
And then in that sense, maybe you are your own reader. And so maybe Tina is the reader of this book. And she did accomplish like a pretty extraordinary thing in her career. And certainly like it warrants that like, wow, can you believe like I had this conversation with, you know, Madonna or whatever, you know, it's like, yeah, if I had that conversation, I would also want to take note of it, you know, that seems fair to me. There is something, it is depressing. I will say this part was quite depressing to me to realize how many of the people that she's talking about are still figures in American cultural life.
Ugh, depressing.
That generation has got to get off the fucking stage. Like, it is, like, so grim. Donald Trump certainly looms large in the book, in part because she's, of course, aware of what would go on to happen to him. And so she, I don't know, maybe she didn't. You get the sense that she sort of revisited that material to sort of, like, make something that was salient to a contemporary reader. But he's also just been a figure in American cultural life for a long time, yeah. You know, like a buffoon who became the king. There are a lot of names like that. I mean, I mentioned Kissinger. There's just like these people, I don't know. They're just like, they've hung around for so long. I'm sort of tired of thinking about them.
Yeah. They do last and last. It's kind of uncanny.
I was going to ask on the other side, you know, as opposed to the long lasting, the like punctum of the punctum of history, is there a sense of like current events or like world events? I'm curious, you know, like what was Tina Brown writing, yeah. Like Srebrenica happened today or something, you know, like that, yeah, kind of stuff?
There is. That does come to figure. And she is extraordinarily proud of Vanity Fair's legacy as an institution of journalism.
Rightly or wrongly?
Also something that is, well, I mean, that's something that's hard to understand as a contemporary person, because now we have the internet, like the metabolism of everything is so much faster, but at the time that didn't exist. And so you could, you know, I mean, she's extremely pleased with herself about what's his name, Dominic Dunn, who I think is the most boring journalist alive. And you know, I think it's very silly to be like, oh, Dominic Dunn was this sort of like great journalist. I mean, he's like an annoying gas bag. but it's also possible that I was too young to have read like the journalism for which, you know, that had sort of made his career. And that, so I think the first time I read anything by him was around the murder of Martha Moxley, the Kennedy, like one of the Kennedy cousins murdered this girl, right? Like, and Vanity Fair sort of covered that. And it was like, I mean, I was probably like 17 years old. And I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, this isn't interesting to me. Maybe I'm not really equipped to sort of weigh in on his larger legacy, but it is plain that that is an important part of what she saw their accomplishment as having been. And that it was that thing that was celebrity, yes, but and also like art, that the ability to sort of hire great photographers and invest in sort of a visual sensibility, but the gravitas of what she was doing is what allowed her to become the editor of The New Yorker.
The American feature, right? Like the Rolling Stone and the Playboy. Yeah. That's a magazine thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you mentioned, Joe, you were like a big magazine reader, and we were talking about Kat Marnell, and Kat, I think, has written a lot about how
great editor memoir.
Obsessively and lavishly she attended to magazines, and feeling like, okay, well, the thing that feels like it's missing, maybe one way to describe it is like point of view. And that somebody like Anna Wintour, for whatever shortcomings, you know, it's like she has that kind of distinctive point. She has a perspective. She has a point of view. And so she has taste. My question is, like, can great tastemakers also be moral actors? Because, you know, Tina Brown, like, spending all this time with Henry Kissinger, for instance, like, that feels to me like completely predictable, right? And inexcusable. And I'm kind of, like, strident, and I'm probably, like, maybe unusually, like, judgmental or something in that capacity.
You're a maverick.
I'm kind of a maverick. Okay. But I'm gonna say, and we have to bleep it out, but, like, her taste and her style, to me, are, like, unimpeachable. And I'm also like, I don't know that you have a moral core, and more I'm kind of like looking for that in people.
But that's also the other way around. It's like an amorality chic is part of New York personality. And it's also totally has to do with Tina Brown. It's like, I'm so mean. I work at Vanity Fair. I know everything, and get out my fucking face, you know?
So what do you two think? Do you think we could, like, because I miss that. I crave like taste.
Point of
view. I crave it.
I crave taste too. I do too. I think I don't know if this is generational. I don't know if younger people. I don't know really anyone who is like 22 now, but I wonder what they look at and think about to develop their own sense of taste. My education, much like Kat's education, happened in magazines. Mm-hmm. I read The New Yorker when Tina Brown was the editor, and prior to that when I was in high school, and like that became like my this foundational stuff for me. Like I would tear those fucking Richard Avedon pictures out of The New Yorker and pin them on my
my
high school bedroom.
That, speaking of Kissinger, can you believe that Cy Hirsch is like still a part of our like
a lot
lives?
Of these people, a lot of these people are still, you know, they're still out there. They're still doing it. And it's kind of crazy. I mean, some of them are great at what they do and they should be doing it for, you know, as long as they can. But then some of them you're like, Jesus Christ, like what? Enough already, you know? I don't think taste is predicated on, I think it is possible to have taste and be a moral actor, but it's also, the inverse is also possible, right? Like Leni Riefenstahl had great taste, you know, like created sort of like indelible visual language of something that's like atrocious.
But to Charlotte's point about having a point of view, I mean, I was just racking my mind thinking, you know, what are the best editor memoirs that I've read? I was thinking, well, Kat Marnell's is really great, although I don't know if that counts as it's kind of an editorial memoir. And then Diana Athill's is the only one that I could think of that's really, really great. It's called Stet, and she worked at that publishing house for a bajillion years. She was V.S. Naipaul's editor, and she's incredibly underrated and uncredited, essentially. And I met her in her like very old age before she died, and I packed up her library when she was going into for the bookshop I worked at. And so I got to see, you know, like, and every single book on her shelf was like personally dedicated. And the point of view she communicates in the book is really incredible. But I don't think they have a lot of peers.
Which is unfortunate. I mean, the editor, like a good editor or maybe the best editor is not somebody who can have an outsized sense of ego always, right? Like sometimes you're better suited to the job if you're able to sort of like sublimate your ego into the work of your writer or your star, right?
Great point.
Right? Like I think that's sort of, but, and so Tina Brown in that case is, And she's not talking about herself as someone who is line editing, right? She's talking about herself as someone who is sort of shepherding or, you know, almost like creative directing a little universe in which people who are really good at what they did were liberated to do what they do. And I do miss that. And I do think we are at a very different place. And I don't know if younger writers and readers understand how different it is and how comparatively impoverished I think it is. I think there are smart, interesting people writing a Substack or, you know, putting together a newsletter or an Instagram or whatever, but it's not the same as having multiple different sharp eyes picking apart something in a way that is thought-provoking or understanding how to say like, oh, you know who I would love to have take this picture is this photographer. Or you know who I would love to have writing about Chanel is this particular writer who's never written about fashion before, whatever, you know, whatever that is. I just think there's so much less of that now, and it's kind of a shame.
It is.
I do think we are at an unfortunate moment where expertise is not valued. And so you can leave open the question of whether Tina Brown was an expert. But what seems inarguable to me is that she did function at this very high level and she did accomplish something pretty extraordinary. And it's fun to have this document of this moment that no longer exists and that I felt so wistful for. And so, like, I just felt so bummed when I finished reading this book and I was like, God, we just don't have this thing anymore. And it's not that I need to be told what to think or what to buy, although maybe I do. But I just, yeah, I don't know. I love the idea of having access to somebody smart and interesting telling me about the stuff.
I think, honestly, now super rich people underestimate how influential things like magazines and prestige media brands, whatever, peer review, literature in general, how influential that stuff actually is to like the slice of society whose minds they would like to, you know, be in connection with. And those things actually remain, you know, like The New Yorker, sure, but The Economist, the freaking, yeah. You know, these are self-selecting communities of people who subscribe to things because there's data in there that they want for their work and they are professionals. And it helps to feed into what the idea of a professional is. And it's interesting. Of course, there are people who still invest in that. You know, the Gettys, the people who have intellectual architecture around them are still interested in wielding power that way. But it's interesting, you know, because there are some people still make their names doing it, I suppose.
It's just unfortunate that we're at a point where, like, what you're describing, like the Paris Review is a good example, I think, mm-hmm. feels like a private luxury. It feels like a luxury expense. Vanity Fair you could buy it at the grocery store. So that kind of experience, that to spend that $3 and have access to, like, Richard Avedon and Madonna and Kate Moss and, like, you know, this film criticism or whatever, like, it was kind of a bargain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's still possible now, certainly. Like, I subscribe to Book Forum, you know, I still care about that stuff. And I think Book Forum is good, but, like, I, you know, they're not selling it at the grocery store. And, you know, I don't know if, like, closeted teenagers are buying Book Forum the way I once bought Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. And I know I'm just, like, I'm old enough now to just be that person who's like, things were better when I was younger. But and maybe that's boring and predictable, and maybe there is a 20-year-old listening to this show who's like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like,
this is
if I want to read the magazine, I'll buy an old magazine on eBay, you know, or whatever. And maybe they're right, and, like, God bless, but, like, I feel a little adrift without that ballast culturally.
Mm.
Yeah. No, it is a loss. I think you can objectively say sometimes things were better. Certainly, like, you know, people's ability to buy homes or something. And for that matter, yeah. People's ability to make a living as a writer. Yes, that used to be better. Yeah. And actually, yeah. I feel like it's coming to the younger culture through looking at rom-coms where journalism was supposed to be, like, glamorous and support your city lifestyle and fun. And
absolutely.
Well, speaking of magazines, I mean, I think working, Roman and I, you know, are working together was at the New Republic, you know, with the toxic legacy, a toxic political legacy, but
a bottomless private fortune.
A bottomless private fortune, right? And a direct channel of influence to a certain group. And the economics of it, they do change and they don't change. Parts of, you know, the money's organized differently, but the lawyers are still getting paid more than everybody else. That kind of stuff.
And the owners. Yeah, absolutely. But, like, that stuff, it does matter. And I think it's easy and in some ways, like, not that interesting when younger people, and it's not just young people who do this, sort of rail against corporate media or contemporary media, and they're like, oh, this is, you know, whatever. It is what it is. It's fucked up. It's the man, so to speak. But I was writing a piece. I was very briefly an editor at the New York Times, which is a whole other conversation. And I was writing a piece when I was there, and I was working with an editor, the kind of editor I'm talking about, the kind of editor who is so fucking smart and so deliberate and so thoughtful about what she does. And she was just reading it as the second read for me. And she said this thing to me that absolutely blew my mind. She said to me, well, when the obituary desk hears that this woman has died, they're going to pull your piece to figure out how to write about her. And I was like, Jesus Christ, like, no pressure. That is, like, such a high pressure thing to say. However, that is, like, a very interesting way to understand the power of what is being done by people at magazines and newspapers. And I felt, like, very small when she said that to me. And I'm really glad she said that to me. And that really changed how I thought about the piece I was trying to write. And I think that's very true. And that is testament to how powerful that kind of stuff is, which is why it should be done by people who know what they're doing and not by, like, an intern and ChatGPT and, you know, the CMS, and that's it, you're done. You know, that's the first draft of reality. You know, it's so grim.
Read
Reading Writers is hosted and produced by Joe Livingstone and Charlotte Shane, and released in partnership with Book Forum Magazine. You can learn more about us and support the show at www.patreon.com/readingwriters. You can also write to us at readingwriterspod@gmail.com with questions, comments, and praise, or leave a review for us wherever you listen.
Profound thanks also to Marty Zolkow and Joe Valley, who composed the beautiful music you are listening to now.